Chapter 12. The Second Rule of Music Craft. On our first Friday morning, all the seventh graders gather in the main auditorium, called the Shell. It's the huge vaulting concert hall at the far end of campus, shaped kind of like an armadillo shell. The whole seventh grade class fills up only one small section of the seats. In front of us is an enormous stage, dark except for a lone spotlight shining down on a microphone stand. I slump in my seat, yawning from staying up late to study my homework. I sat for hours in the dorm's shared bathroom, feet pulled up on the toilet seat so no one would notice me and make me go to bed. But my first week of classes proved one dire fact. I am very far behind my classmates. They play on a level I didn't even know kids my age could. And if I'm going to catch up and earn my place here, I can't waste time sleeping. So I'm tired and cranky, and my feet are sore from being squished inside my tiny shoes all week. At the end of the first day of class, I shoved my old boots deep into the closet. If being the perfect Mistwick musician means curling my toes all day and hobbling a bit when I walk, so be it. Mrs. LaRue herself walks out. I haven't seen her since the planting ceremony. Today, she wears a bright, multicolored caftan. A gold comb in her hair sends up a spray of feathers that sway as she crosses to the microphone. "Good morning, students. Today's lesson is one of the most important you will learn here," she says. I sit up straighter. If it's important enough, they'll call a full assembly and Mrs. LaRue. I better not miss a word. "I know you've all heard the rules of music craft over and over again." We all groan, nodding. But Mrs. LaRue doesn't smile. "Unfortunately, sometimes we can hear a thing so many times that it begins to lose its meaning. Tell me, students, what is the second rule of music craft?" Together we recite, "Lest you be doomed by your own art, always finish what you start." Mrs. LaRue nods seriously. "We all know what this rhyme means, that it is very dangerous to leave a spell unfinished. An incomplete spell leaves all sorts of uncontrolled and unstable forces hanging about." She takes a long pause, letting the words sink in as her eyes slowly sweep over our faces. I know the rule well. It's why when you're just practicing a spell, you should always skip the first few notes, so you don't create any magic that might get out of control. Playing a few measures over and over in practice is harmless. But if you start at the beginning, trigger the magic, and then don't finish it, you end up with a spoiled spell. And those can be very dangerous, depending on how powerful the spell is. Even if you mess up, you have to pull it together and keep going, or let someone else jump in and finish the spell for you, which is always embarrassing. "Often in your life," Mrs. LaRue continues, "you will find yourself playing in situations that are distracting or unsettling. Anger, sadness, and other powerful emotions can compromise your composure, causing errors or even preventing you from completing your spell. Sometimes you'll be with other musicians who can close the spell if you're unable. But the leading cause of magical injury, from bruised hands to charred instruments, comes from unfinished solo spells, especially if you're dealing with maestro-level magic." I swallow hard, thinking suddenly of my mom. Is that what happened to her? Did she fail to complete a spell? Mrs. LaRue flicks a finger, and the four class maestros come walking solemnly onto the stage. Miss Nurani, Mr. Walter, Miss Becker, and Mr. Pinwhistle. They stand in a row and watch us grimly. I start to feel uneasy, wondering where this is leading. It doesn't sound like we'll be peeling apples or conjuring butterflies. Mr. Pinwhistle's sour gaze sweeps over us and lingers a second too long on me, and I could swear his nose wrinkles a little more than usual. "Each of you will soon enter a room," Mrs. LaRue says, "and there you will play a simple spell. Meanwhile, your maestros will be playing another spell that you will not be able to hear, but you will see its effects. They will try to unsettle you, to make you angry, afraid, even terribly sad. Your simple task will be to control yourself and finish what you start. Play through the emotions. As she leans into the microphone, it's like she's staring straight into my soul. I cannot impress upon you the importance of this exercise, except to say that one day, your lives may depend upon it. With that, she leaves the stage, vanishing as suddenly as she appeared. In silent, solemn rows, we file out of the auditorium and through a door that leads behind the stage. There, we find a bunch of little soundproof rooms, sort of like the cubicles in the Aero classroom, except these ones aren't see-through. We're split into lines to take our turns four at a time. I don't know which maestro I'm paired with, but I assume it's Mr. Pinwhistle. I end up in the back of my line. Jai's at the back of his too, and he gives me a smile, but it's a weak one. So we finally found something that makes Jai Kapoor nervous. That doesn't make me feel the least bit better. We can't see into or hear anything coming out of the practice rooms, so I have no idea what form the exercise will take. As the kids ahead of me finish their turns and leave, they don't stick around to give the rest of us tips. Instead, most of them hurry away as fast as they can, looking like they're about to puke. A lot of them are crying. One girl sinks into the corner, hugging her viola, shaking so badly I worry she's in shock. But then Miss March appears and takes her gently away. Jai and I exchange looks. "Did your parents ever tell you about this?" I whisper. He shakes his head. It reminds me a little of the auditions, which, of course, sets me to panicking. Then I remember the point of this is to not panic. So I start panicking about panicking. Great. This is going to go fan-fiddle-tastically. Finally, my turn comes. Rabia leaves the room I'm about to enter, sobbing quietly, trembling so much she can barely move her cello. I give her a questioning look, hoping she'll give me some clue what to expect. But she just shakes her head and shuffles away. "Good luck," Jai whispers, before stepping into his little room. Drawing a deep breath, I walk inside, shutting the door behind me. My hands are sweating so much that I worry I'll drop my flute. I wipe them on my skirt and look around. There's not much to see, just padded walls and a bare linoleum floor and a metal stand with a 3-page spell on it. Someone has written in tiny letters by the door, "It's all an illusion. Keep your cool." Thanks, random student. That's very reassuring. No one tells me what to do, so I figure I'm just supposed to start. First, I read through the pages. It's Reverie, an illusion spell by Claude Debussy for conjuring light. I find the fingerings easily enough. It's not an easy spell, but it's not too difficult either, as long as I keep my cool. I play slowly, lips pursed slightly as I blow across the embouchure. I miss a few notes, which is to be expected since I haven't played this piece before. But the important thing is to keep playing, even through the mistakes. The melody that fills the little room is dreamy and haunting and a little sad. But that's not the only reason a shiver runs through me. I'm waiting for something to happen, to try and trip me up. I wish they'd at least told us what to expect. My feet pinch, and I shift my weight to try and take pressure off them, which nearly makes me fall over. "Keep your cool, Amelia," I think. "Just keep your cool." Illusion is a type of elemental spell, so the magic that begins to peel away from the flute is pale blue, like shimmering sapphire dust. It twinkles and fades, and in front of me, a white orb begins to grow. At first, it's faint, little more than a fleck of light. But the deeper I get into the music, the brighter it becomes. It's just like the ones Miss Nurani made when we were hunting for my echo tree. It's beautiful. I'm so focused on watching it and reading the music that I don't notice at first that the light around me is dimming. The room is getting darker and colder. Soon, the only light I have to read the music by is my glowing white orb. It hovers over the stand, while the walls, floor, and ceiling fade away into infinite blackness. It's like standing in the heart of the night, with no horizon in view. Nothing exists but the sheets of music, my flute, the ball of light, and me. Unease stirs inside my stomach. I press it down, thinking, it's just an illusion. I imagine Mr. Pinwhistle on the other side of the wall, blasting his bassoon and flooding my little room with his illusions. But then I start to feel heat behind me. I don't turn, I don't take my eyes off the music, but I sense flames leaping up. Then they spread around me, hot and red and angry, until I'm standing in a circle of crackling fire. For an illusion, it feels incredibly real. I begin to sweat from the heat. Panic sparks like fireworks in my chest. The flames are everywhere, hungry and relentless. Unlike the illusion Miss Nurani did at the planting ceremony, this fire actually feels hot. Is it real? Would they trap me in here with an actual fire?
Whatever your mother tried to do that night by the river, it didn't work,
I hear Gran saying in the back of my mind.
And it killed her.
I push away her words. Now is not the time to think about my mom, especially not how she died, or I'll almost definitely fall to pieces and fail this test. Finally, the fire fades away, and something inside me unclenches as it does. The room grows lighter until I can see it's not the same room at all. Instead, I'm standing in the ballroom at the hotel where the auditions were held. My blue light is still hovering overhead, but it's harder to see in this bright room. There's a little acorn in a pot in front of me, and the four maestros are seated behind it. They all stare at me with different expressions. Mr. Pinwhistle looks enraged, Mr. Walters looks bored, Miss Becker looks disgusted, and Miss Nurani looks deeply disappointed. Those looks drag at me like chains around my neck. For a moment, I forget I'm at Mistwick. I think I really am in that ballroom, failing all over again, destroying my own dream, risking everything for silly, stupid hope. Nervousness and shame fill my cheeks with heat. My hands get clammy. I play and play, but the acorn doesn't so much as jiggle. It's not working. I'm going to get kicked out. I'm going to lose everything I ever wanted. It's all an illusion. Keep your cool. The words come just when I need them. Though I'm trembling all over, I force my hands to stay steady. Then the maestros start whispering.
You're not good enough,
says Mr. Pinwhistle.
Why don't you just give up?
Asks Mr. Walters.
Is that chicken poop?
Miss Becker wrinkles her nose. Miss Nurani just shakes her head and adds,
We don't want girls like you. You don't belong here, Amelia Jones. The real Amelia belonged. We wanted her, but we got you instead.
It takes all my might not to whip my flute from my lips and yell that they're all wrong, that I do belong here. At least, that's what I think I'd shout if I could. But a part of me knows they're right. I don't belong at Mistwick. I'm not the real Amelia. I was never meant to be here. I don't know how I keep playing, but I do. Sheer stubbornness, I guess. I always did have a head like a mule, Gran would say. So out of pure spite, I keep playing, because they can whisper all they want. The louder I play, the harder it gets to hear them. Then they vanish like smoke. The room goes dark again, leaving me alone with my music and the bobbing ball of light. Except for the soft notes of my flute, there's total silence. My heart lifts. The test must be over. Everything comes in threes, right? I passed three tests: darkness, fire, and the audition. And I'm still playing strong. I may have wobbled a bit and missed a note or two, but I didn't quit. They didn't beat me. But I still have one page of music left to play, and the lights don't come on yet. It's just me, standing in a pool of light, my glowing orb floating like a bright bubble over my head. I feel like I've been standing here for ages,
My legs are sore. My hands and arms are tired from holding up my flute, and I'm losing my breath. Shifting slightly to give my legs a break, I feel something against my shoe. Something like water? I chance a look down between notes and see I'm standing in an inky puddle, or not a puddle, a wide, shallow pool, and that pool is getting deeper. In seconds, the water is to my knees, then my waist. A current rises, pushing against me like I'm standing in a river that's getting stronger and stronger. Looking around, I don't see anything but dark, rising water. The light of my illusion spell ripples on the choppy surface. The water reaches my chest. I raise my arms so it can't throw off my playing. I wonder if the maestros use the same illusions on all the kids, and if so, how did Rabia manage this test with her cello? The thought comes and goes like a fly, and soon all I can focus on is keeping my flute above water. The stand with the papers somehow stays still, but the current is so strong now that I can barely stay on my feet. I brace against the flow, convinced the test has to end soon, or I'll be completely submerged in water. Just an illusion. Keep your cool. But it doesn't end. The water reaches my chin. Only my hands and flute and head are above the surface. The current drags at me hungrily. Despite my efforts, my fingers grow clumsy and I hit a few bad notes, and the ball of light shrinks to the size of a pea. I'm standing chin-deep in a powerful river in almost total darkness. I keep playing, desperate and terrified, trying to remember the last few measures of the spell since the light isn't strong enough to illuminate the pages. The notes jumble in my head, and I frantically pound the keys of my flute, but the ball of light doesn't grow again. Then I see something. A girl, standing in the corner of the room. She's so faint I can barely make her out, but something about her is familiar. Her features are blurred, like she's a watercolor painting. Is she part of the illusion? She watches me silently, with eyes like gaping holes. A shiver runs over my skin. Then she starts toward me. I back away, fighting against the current, but the water doesn't seem to slow her down. She raises a hand, which is pale white and transparent. I shake my head, still playing my flute, telling myself she isn't real, isn't real, isn't... Losing my balance, I plunge underwater. This isn't an illusion. It's a memory. I'm sinking, drowning, clawing for air that I cannot find. Instead of my 12-year-old body, I feel small and weak, 4 years old again. I can't seem to remember how to swim. I'm totally at the river's mercy, and it is merciless. Opening my mouth to scream, I shut my eyes and twist this way and that, terror coursing through me. I can feel myself getting weak, sparks dance in my eyes. I'm drowning. I'm drowning, and I'm reaching for my mother, but she isn't there. She was there. She was there beside me, and so was my father. But I slipped and fell into the river, and they called my name, but the current carried me swiftly away, out of their arms, into total darkness. The lights come on, revealing the little soundproof room. I'm curled up into a ball on the floor, sobbing for Gran. There's no water anywhere, except for my salty tears and the snot running from my nose. It was an illusion after all, but my body reacted as if it were real. My flute is clutched to my chest, and the music stand has toppled over. The pages lie scattered about. The strange, ghostly girl has vanished.
Amelia.
I shake my head, curling up tighter.
Amelia, dear, it's over. You can get up now. You did it. You finished the spell.
Shaking, I slowly turn my head to see Miss Nurani standing over me. She bends down, softly touching my hair.
It's all over, she says again.
It's all an illusion. Keep your cool. But I hadn't kept my cool at all. I feel so completely, utterly uncool that I start sobbing all over again. Miss Nurani helps me up.
We walk out of the room together, and I try to get a grip on myself. All I want right now is Gran. Her arms around me, squeezing me till I can't breathe in the way that used to always annoy me, but which I now miss more than anything. But Gran isn't here. She hasn't even responded to the emails I've sent her, though I've been sure to write at least every other day. Was it you who did that to me? I ask Miss Nurani in a trembling voice. She gives me an apologetic smile.
You did well. Better than I'd expected, really. I thought I had you with the audition illusion.
Anger rushes through me. And what about the river? What about my parents? Did you think you had me then? Her brow furrows.
What? I didn't conjure your parents. Just the water.
What about the girl? I demand. The girl who tried to drown me. She looks totally confused.
What girl? There was no girl. It was just an illusion.
Just an illusion, I'm yelling now. Just an illusion. This is not just an illusion. I press my hand to my chest, which feels like a cage full of snakes, angry and twisted up and crawling.
Amelia, it's a standard exercise.
She is cut short by a scream. It comes from the little room on our left, despite the walls being soundproof. I look around. Where's Jai? Miss Nurani tries to grab my arm, but I pull away and throw open the door of the room. Jai is huddled in the corner, still screaming. A huge, salivating dog with enormous fangs is standing over him, snarling and snapping, foam dripping from its massive jaws. Weirdly, between its snarls, it speaks in a human voice that sounds eerily like Jai's dad.
Enough! It's time to get serious! You're a disgrace!
Jai is trying to play his violin, but then he gives up, throwing it aside to put up his hands instead in a feeble attempt to hold off the rabid dog. No, I shout, jumping between them. Jai, it isn't real! The last page of the Debussy spell is still on Jai's stand, behind the dog, while the other pages are scattered on the floor, so he must have made it through most of the piece before the dog appeared. A faintly glowing ball of light hovers over the page, on the verge of flickering out altogether. I quickly raise my flute and play the last few lines, completing Jai's spell for him, and the light strengthens. I play so fast and so fiercely that the orb grows until it's like a small sun, blinding the dog. All the light particles that Jai's assigned maestro assembled to create it become mine to manipulate instead. The dog doesn't stand a chance. I obliterate him totally. I finish the spell like the good Mistwick musician I am, then lower my flute and turn to Jai. The bright light fades away. Putting my arms around him, I hold him tight and whisper, "It's over, Jai. It was all an illusion, and it's over now." He grips my arms so tight it hurts, but I just wince and don't let go. He's shaking like a leaf in a storm. After a few moments, his sobs turn to sniffs, and he pulls away. Keeping his eyes averted, he mumbles, "Thanks." I nod and pick up his violin, handing it back to him. Hearing a grunt behind me, I turn to see Mr. Pinwhistle has joined Miss Nurani, and he's looking hard at me. I guess he was the one testing Jai. Defiantly, I stand and snatch up my flute, then help Jai up. Together, we glare right back and march out of the room. Without a word, we go past the two maestros and head for the door leading outside. I'm still shaking, but now it's from rage. I know interrupting Jai's test won't help me prove to the maestros I belong here, but for once, I don't care.
That was completely out of line, Miss Jones,
Mr. Pinwhistle says. But he's got a funny look in his eyes, like he's puzzled.
Consider yourself in last chair for the entirety of next week.
I turn and shout back,
"Worth it!"
I let the door slam behind me on the way out.